What is Zionism? What is its history? And what is its opposition, anti-Zionism? And what constitutes this history? The conversation has gotten so loud, yet it seems people don't really know the definitions of the terms themselves. It's time to cut through the rhetoric, noise, slogans, and soundbites and offer the debate an intelligible context. Join us to journey through the historical roots of this debate.
The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
In each episode, we will explore how every type of Zionist thought was opposed by a certain brand of anti-Zionism. And we reflect on how these various debates persist to this day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the history of two opposing ideas. Let's take stock of where we're at. Last episode, we talked about how political Zionism began and covered a brief summary of Jewish history. Following the Roman exile from their homeland, the Jewish people spread all over the globe. A nation without a land, a people in exile, the Jewish people were forced to reimagine their nation, centering their existence around cultural traditions, a shared past and present, and were held together as a collective by the promise of future return to Israel. In the 19th century, the Enlightenment popularized ideas of the citizen, nation-state, and of equal rights. Jews in Western Europe were promised emancipation for the first time. The ghetto walls came down, and the way the Jews had been living for a millennia ruptured in a rapidly changing world. From this emerged the Jewish question. What does it mean to be Jewish in the modern world? Many Jews were excited about this promise to finally be seen as equal and were willing to do everything to make it work. Relegate Judaism to the home, pledge their allegiance to their host European nations, fight and die for them in war. Other Jews saw the writing on the wall and saw that the promise of emancipation was a false one. Theodor Herzl, the quintessentially assimilated Jew, was triggered by a few experiences to recognize that Europeans could never truly accept the Jews. He sensed with a prophetic and incredible urgency that the Jews needed to get the hell out of Europe. And this was about 100 years before the Holocaust. In the global transition from empires to nation states, Zionism emerged as one of the many liberation movements of people looking to secure self-determination. Now we turn our attention to a new Zionist and anti-Zionist pairing within the Jewish community, Labour Zionism versus Communism, Socialism, and Bundism. All Zionists were deeply concerned with transforming the Jew to become masters of their own fate. A chance to liberate themselves from the impoverished and oppressed existence in the ghettos and diaspora. Labour Zionists believed a working relationship to the land was imperative to the well-being of a people. Other Jews opposed the idea of Israel because they were against the existence of all nation-states, fighting instead for a global socialist utopia. Here's the historical breakdown.
So the next pair we're going to discuss of Zionism and anti-Zionism is Communism, Socialism, Bundism as representing anti-Zionism, and Labour Zionism for Zionism. Most of the Jews at this point, at the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century, are living in an area, much of it in present-day Ukraine, some Poland, some Russia, that was called the Pale of Settlement. That was essentially an area that was allocated where Jews could live in order to prevent them from going into the major cities. And many of the issues and discussions that are taking place in Jewish life at that time are expressed among the Jews in the Pale of Settlement.
Let's cover the basic timeline of Bundism and Labour Zionism. Towards the end of the 20th century, a majority of European Jewry, about 5 million Jews, lived in the Pale of Settlement. Between the late 18th century and the early 20th century, the Russian Tsar allocated the Pale for inhabitants by Jewish subjects, forbidding them to live outside of it. While the Jews were never a majority in the Pale of Settlement, they did establish townlets, or shtetls, which were inhabited almost exclusively by Jews. Much of shtetl life was defined by traditional Judaism and the Yiddish language. In addition, since Jews were forbidden from owning land and working it, they had to engage in money lending and craftsmanship. In the middle part of the 19th century, some of the limitations placed on Jewish movement and professional opportunities were lifted, though many were kept in place, including the prohibition on Jewish land ownership. In 1881, massive pogroms, or violent massacres, were launched against the Jews of Kiev and other areas of the Pale, resulting in the deaths of dozens of Jews. These pogroms, largely tolerated and even encouraged by the Tsar, sparked an intense debate amongst the Eastern European Jews. What do we do now? Two solutions were especially popular and progressive. The first was Bundism, an ideology and movement that promoted socialism and Jewish equality within the Pale. The second was Jewish nationalism, particularly Labour Zionism. The Bund was officially established in the same year as the Zionist movement, 1897. For the next decade at least, the Bund attracted a larger membership. It organized workers' strikes and political activism to promote the right of Jewish workers. The Bund's leadership, all avid Marxists, believed that more Jews would be convinced of socialist ideals and would join revolutionary communists in their struggle if their movement maintained some vestiges of Jewish culture, including the Yiddish language. Jewish nationalism was led first by the Chabad Zion movement, an organization that encouraged immigration and settlement in Ottoman Palestine. In 1897, the Zionist movement was established and absorbed many members of the Chabad Zion. Then came the second and third Aliyah. Between 1904 and 1914, and 1919 and 1923, about 75,000 Eastern European Jews immigrated to Palestine with a desire to labor the land. These Zionists, known as the original Labor Zionists, carried socialist convictions that they sought to enact in the settlements established and yet to be established. This is the legacy of Ben-Gurion, an emigrant from Poland. Ben-Gurion was initially a farmer in Palestine before taking on essential leadership roles in the pre-state Zionist politics, ultimately becoming the first prime minister of Israel. As a farmer turned prime minister, Ben-Gurion was the ultimate fulfillment of the Labour Zionist dream. Both of these movements were responding to the Jewish condition, the Jewish question in Eastern Europe, more than they were responding to each other. The larger political climate of the time was shaped by the growing appeal of socialism. Herein lies the context and appeal of Bundism and Labour Zionism. Ultimately, both Bundists and Labour Zionists sought to eradicate shtetl culture. Both sought to rid their communities of what they considered outdated religiosity and to expand the social and professional opportunities of Eastern European Jewry. The main difference between the two groups, at least in the beginning, was the where. Bundists wanted to stay here, Labour Zionists wanted to go there. Now, how did Labour Zionists replace the shtetl? Well, there were many ways, but let's just touch on two. First, Labour Zionists banned Yiddish and embraced modern Hebrew. Second, Labour Zionists established kibbutzim. A kibbutz is a Jewish agriculture settlement operating according to socialist principles. The work is divided among the residents. Food is prepared and shared together. Children are raised collectively. The allocation of resources is determined by a communal council. In essence, the kibbutz was supposed to contain the opposite spirit of the shtetl: modern, Hebrew-speaking, agricultural, independent, and strong. Bundism, originally, was against the creation of a Jewish state. Bundism was not a response to Zionism,
It was a response to the impoverished and perilous condition of Jews in Eastern Europe. But still, in order to advocate for geographic and cultural hereness, political hereness was required as well. At that time, political hereness meant opposition to Zionism. Back to our timeline. We can see how in the wake of World War I, the Zionist movement was gaining more and more support. Furthermore, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, which among other things abolished the Pale of Settlement, as well as the Holocaust, which decimated European Jewry, were fatal blows to the Bund. The Bund's idea of hereness, of remaining in Europe, was no longer attractive. So, by 1945, Zionism carried the day among Eastern European Jews, both in the Land of Israel and in Eastern Europe.
Last time we talked about the excitement that emancipation had for Jews. We talked about political Zionism being one of the possible exciting ideas of responses to the Jewish condition, but communism was certainly one of the most exciting ideas. Now, again, this is where we need to think like the contemporaries. Today we think about communism, certainly communism in Russia and the Soviet Union, as a failed ideology. It might be difficult to recreate the sense of excitement, but we need to understand that for many Jews, communism was deeply exciting. And it's not a conspiracy theory that many Jews were overrepresented in the communist movement. They were overrepresented because communism had a special appeal for Jews. And the appeal was that communism offered a utopia of international equality where it would no longer matter that Jews are Jews, because they would be subsumed into that international brotherhood of equals. They wouldn't need to convert. They would just become part of this utopia of equals. So communism was deeply appealing to Jews who were struggling with the question of modernity, of how to be a Jew in the modern era, how to fit in. And communism gave an appealing answer to where the Jews would fit in. Also, because communism was against Tsarist Russia, especially after the revolution, it brought down the Tsar, it brought down the system of the Tsar. Communism spoke against anti-Semitism. Lenin, for example, was one of the most foremost spokespeople against anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was associated with the Tsar, with the forgery of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So in communism, the Jews found both a utopia of international equality, where they would fit in and where their being Jewish would not matter, and they also found a very strong voice that spoke against anti-Semitism. So this was the appeal of communism to Jews. Now, communism, of course, also opposed Zionism. Zionism at this point is a new idea. It begins to emerge. It's still marginal among most Jews, but to the extent that it addressed it, communism opposed it because communism opposed what it viewed as the particular nature of national liberation movements. It viewed them as bourgeoisie movements, of movements that stood in the way of achieving this global utopia of equality. Jews like Rosa Luxemburg, who was a devout communist, she does not only oppose Zionism as the liberation movement of the Jewish people, she opposes the liberation of the Czechs and the Poles and the Ukrainians to the extent that they want to do it through national self-determination. They think it's important to appeal to the workers and their languages and to help them organize, but ultimately, whether Lenin or Rosa Luxemburg, they look at Zionism, at the idea of the national revival of the Jewish people, as something that belongs to the bourgeoisie or to the rabbis. Communism, of course, was very secular, so was Bundism, and of course Zionism. Communism, Bundism, and Zionism all share the fact that they are at this moment very secular ideas. So communism was anti-Zionism in the sense that the communist utopia necessitated there not being a particular form of Jewish liberation. Bundism was another appealing idea for Jews. Bundism tried to kind of strike a middle way between communism and Zionism. Bundism basically began as a way of organizing Jewish workers with socialist ideas, and it speaks about Jews liberating themselves, attaining equality as working people here. And here means the Pale of Settlement. So Bundism had the notion of here-ness. We are going to improve the conditions of Jews where Jews were, essentially in the Pale of Settlements. And in that sense, it opposed Zionism because Zionism wanted the Jews to go there. In a symbolic way, the organization of the Bund is established in 1897 at the same year of the first Zionist Congress. And again, gives you a sense of the contemporary field of competing ideas. Bundism claimed that Jews will be liberated with their brethren, the Poles, the Ukrainians, everyone attaining that equality, the liberation of the working man. But it required that the Jews stay where they are. It was also opposed by communism for being a bit too specific. And of course, it was opposed by Zionism, who felt that the Bundists did not understand what the future held, and that the only way that Jews could truly be liberated is by going to the one geography, the one land where Jews made sense, which is the land of Israel. So this is socialism and Bundism and why they had such an appeal for Jews. And for many Jews at that moment in the early 20th century, communism and Bundism feels like the future. So labor Zionism is designed to appeal to Jews at precisely the moment where communism and Bundism and their promises of utopia are also appealing to Jews. Labor Zionism wanted to bring together the universal appeal of the labor movement, of communism, of socialism, with the specific appeal of Zionism. And labor Zionism made both universal and particular claims. The first element of labor Zionism was the idea that national revival, the ability of the Jews to change their condition, to truly attain liberty, depended first and foremost, not just on the general return to the land, so coming to the land of Israel and establishing a state, but a physical return to laboring the land. Because they were barred from owning land over the centuries, they were not working the land. So the idea is that the Jews were not just a people without a land, without the land of Israel, but rather also a people who did not have the benefit of working the land. The idealized person of labor Zionism was a Jewish farmer working the land. And that, at the moment, seemed entirely insane, but that was the ideal. And it was such a compelling ideal that you have young Jews who are inspired by the idea of labor Zionism. They are teenagers, early 20s, who are leaving university education. They have degrees. They are highly educated. But they throw all that away and they begin to immigrate here with the second, the third immigration waves, aliyahs, and the idea for them is to work the land. So labor Zionism posed a lot of elements of sickness versus health. The sickness of the Jews living in the Galut, in exile, not working the land, with the healthy, upright Jew who lives on his own historical land, the land of Israel, and also works that land. And that process in itself was about healing the Jew, about creating a new Jew. And you read the poetry at the time, it binds together an almost religious sentiment describing the land of Israel, the working of the land in both religious terms and terms of labor. Now, labor Zionism also made the claim that it was not just for Jews or about Jews. One of the most important early thinkers, Moses Hess, brought up both the particular and the universal. The labor Zionist thinkers said that by working the land, by healing the Jewish condition, they would be able to contribute to the global utopia of equality. So labor Zionists did not separate themselves from the utopias of socialism and communism, but they basically said that they need to heal the Jews in order for Jews to be full and equal participants in those utopias. The other way that labor Zionism sought to bring together the universal and the particular is about creating institutions, socialist institutions in the land of Israel. And in the early 20th century, Zionism creates some of the most advanced institutions of universal health care and labor unions. And their vision is that they can get it right from the beginning. Unlike the communists in Russia, they don't need to bring down a feudal system of aristocracy that owns lands. They don't need to take land from the aristocracy and divide it among the proletariat. They can do it right from the beginning. They call their socialism constructive socialism. Labor Zionism could begin from scratch because they were coming to a new land, because they were purchasing the land. Labor Zionism begins initially with purchasing land in order to work it. They had these collective ways of working the lands, the kibbutzim, those socialized mini utopias where they could create the utopia of equality, of a worker equality from the ground up.
What was the role of women in this socialist liberation revolution movement?
So from the beginning, because Zionism viewed itself as a very forward-looking movement, so Herzl, his vision, even though it was very bourgeois and not socialist, had a very liberal, forward-looking vision. So beginning in the Second Zionist Congress, women vote. This is one of the earliest organizations in the world where women are equal participants and have the equal right to vote. And labor Zionists, of course, as part of their vision of a utopia of equal human beings and liberation, was also feminist. So women were also laborers, and you have those images of early labor Zionism, the women on the kibbutz, and they are also workers, and they are in the shorts, and they no longer, the dresses, if they brought a dress from home in Europe, the dresses are no longer useful because they are equal to the male laborers. Of course, now when we study it, we know that it wasn't always so, and some of the jobs that were allocated to the women in the kibbutz were some of the more female jobs, but as a whole, the ideal of labor Zionism was a very feminist ideal of complete equality of men and women. It also went to the notion of that the kibbutz was the family. So in the beginning, the children of the kibbutz would not be raised by their families. They would be raised collectively in children's homes. So the kibbutz, this new socialist utopia, was to replace the family. And that, of course, created its own sets of problems, but it was the notion that this is how you liberate women from the home
and this is how they can be equal. So a lot of these ideas that are all around Europe at that time of equality and utopia and socialism and feminism, Zionism absorbs a lot of those ideas into its own vision.
As we were reading all of the labor Zionists and what they said, they do use the words colony and settle the land and that kind of phrasing. So obviously today that has a colonial connotation, but what is the meaning of those words in that historical context?
For labor Zionists, the idea of working the land, being there, settling, not going anywhere, not being nomadic, we need to understand that there's a sense that Jewish life is nomadic, the wandering Jew, it's precarious. They get expelled. They can never be sure that where they are is where they're going to stay. So the idea also of settling, having a place where you're settled that is yours, is either has just an objective connotation or even one that finally ends the Jewish wanderings. And the same idea, there's the notion of colony is not in the sense of, okay, there's going to be a metropole, we belong to London or we belong to Paris, and then we go to a land in order to extract its resources. It was just a way of saying that we're going to come to this land and be there and we're going to be our own people. So a lot of the problems, and that, of course, you remember also from the course, a big part was often to remind or to let the students know what certain words meant in that particular context.
So can we understand Zionism as a decolonial liberation movement?
Absolutely. That is actually the best way to understand Zionism. Sometimes I say that Zionism actually had to overcome four empires before the Jews were fully liberated. So they first had to decolonize themselves from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Zionism emerges mostly in idea in Vienna. And this is the moment where a lot of the peoples of the empire, the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Hungarians, and everyone is speaking about self-determination. The end of the empire is beginning to be at hand. So the first empire that needs to go for Zionism to begin to emerge is the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The next is the Russian Empire, very relevant to our discussion today of labor Zionism. Most of the Jews live in the areas of the Russian Empire. Only when the Russian Empire falls can the Jews begin the process of liberating themselves from that empire. The next empire that has to fall is the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottoman Empire is at this point, at least until World War I, in control of the land of Israel. It is the most recent in a long succession of colonizers and empires who have controlled the land of Israel. So the Ottoman Empire has to fall so that the Jewish people can reclaim the land of Israel. And the final empire that has to fall is the British Empire, that takes over from the Ottoman Empire. So only when all these four empires disappear can the Jews finally liberate themselves. So Zionism in many ways is a quattro decolonial movement. Many empires had to go before the Jews could be finally liberated. The Jews are a very small people. They can't do it on their own. They will need help. They will need legitimacy. This was very central to Herzl's thinking, that Zionism needs international legitimacy. All liberation movements operate against existing power structures. So they always need other forces, other powers to give them legitimacy. No liberation movement is able to achieve liberation on its own. So of course, Zionism appeals to various powers in various countries, and some of them are colonial powers. But there's no question, and this is the thing that for me is very important to emphasize, Zionism is a movement of self-liberation, self-determination of the Jewish people. Nobody sent them, nobody used them. It is the Jews themselves, for themselves, liberating themselves ultimately in their ancient homeland. In the process, they seek legitimacy, they seek help, because the Jews are a small people and they need help. against more powerful forces. But Zionism in itself is a classic movement of decolonization. In the case of Britain, which we'll study, Zionism appeals to help and gets help in the beginning, but ultimately has to fight it.
The Zionists had this new opportunity to build a state from the ground up and really did achieve a socialist utopia. What institutions still remain in Israel from that time, and what character has it given Israel?
One of the things that was clear to the early Zionists that they were taking upon themselves a huge task. They were going to be the generation that would realize the ancient dream of the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in the land. In taking upon themselves such a huge task, they needed networks of mutual support. This could not be an individualistic society. You cannot have a society that says, okay, live and let live, or everyone does whatever they want. These were people who were collectively undertaking a massive task. So they needed systems of support for each other. So they had systems of welfare, essentially. They had systems of universal health care, of helping each other. We saw it recently in the COVID pandemic. Israel had a socialized healthcare system, a universal healthcare system. Everyone could be taken care of very quickly. And that is very much one of the proudest socialist legacies. The early kibbutzim, very few of them today remain as socialized as they used to be. Some still do. The most wealthy of the kibbutzim remain socialist, which sometimes brings me to the idea that it's not that socialism fails, it's just very expensive. So if you have a wealthy kibbutz that exports a lot, then you can maintain a very comfortable healthcare, welfare, education system. Universal education, universal literacy, education systems for everyone. Israel to the present has a universal public education system for all. That is also a legacy of the socialist era. And yes, I think, I mean, Israel has gone through some transformation since, brought in a lot of competition and openness and capitalism. But the socialist legacy where it held is still part of the best things about Israel.
Bundism has seemed to come up in the conversation within the Jewish community recently and has a new appeal today. So after it failed in history, what does it mean in our contemporary moment?
So one of the things about Bundism is, of course, it was tremendously appealing. It brought together both the particular element of the Jewish culture and Yiddish and being where they are. It didn't require the Jews to immigrate to some faraway desert land. And it had tremendous appeal. But of course, the verdict of history has been cruel to Bundism, because the Bundists believed that their fellow Ukrainians, fellow Poles, fellow Russians were really their fellows, that they were together fellow workers, fellow proletariat, that each has a different culture and a different language, but ultimately they are fellow human beings and that they will be protected. And the verdict of history has been cruel. During the Holocaust, which was really the final verdict of that history, but there were pogroms before and persecutions, it became clear that Bundism was in itself a utopia. The fact that in some places you have the revival of Bundism is a way of kind of digging into the past to revive a particular Jewish ideal of anti-Zionism. Because communism was anti-Zionist, but communism was anti-Ukrainian nationalism and anti-Czech nationalism, and it opposed all nationalisms. So for Jews today who still feel that they want their particular Jewish identity, but they feel that they want to reject Zionism, Bundism has this kind of ready-made ideology. First, that where you are is where you stay, the here-ness. So that is ready-made for Jews who believe that where they live is where they should stay. This is one of the things that's appealing about Bundism. The revival of Yiddish, the notion that Yiddish is the kind of the language of Jews in exile. If Hebrew is the language of Jews in the land of Israel, a lot of people who find Bundism appealing today take Yiddish lessons, and they find it appealing to revive that idea. The thing is that they're going back in history and completely ignoring the verdict of history. So they're looking at the appeal of Bundism, which again was tremendously appealing at the end of the 19th century, the early of 20th century. It seemed to be the perfect way to combine the universal proletariat solidarity with the particular emphasis on the Jewish language of Yiddish and Jewish culture and Jewish organization. But their main premise that they would be safe, that where they are is where they stay because their co-workers are their solidarity with their co-workers, then they trust them. To that, the verdict of history was cruel. And to bring that back while neglecting history, and I can see that appeal, but it's deeply ahistorical.
And also, anti-Zionism in any form means something totally different when the state of Israel actually already exists.
Absolutely. Bundism, as we said, was established in 1897. The organization, 1897, is the first Zionist Congress. When Bundism is one of many ideas that are competing for what the Jews, how Jews can be Jews in the modern era, then that's just one of many ideas. You can oppose Zionism and you can oppose communism, and all of these ideas are competing in genuinely trying to solve the Jewish condition. One of the things that characterizes everything that we've studied, emancipation, political Zionism, labor Zionism, socialism, Bundism, communism, is all of these ideas are part of an internal domestic Jewish debate on how to be a Jew in the modern era, how to solve the competing pressures of the universal and the particular. So these are competing ideas, and it's not clear which one of them will win, and they all make a compelling case. Ultimately, Zionism wins not because it made the best arguments. Everyone had excellent arguments. It's just that the verdict of history was cruel to all the other ideas, ultimately leaving only Zionism standing as a relevant idea that solves the question of how to be a Jew in the modern era. Those who want to be anti-Zionist today, when the state of Israel already exists, when we know the verdict of history, are not just engaging in a naive idea and a historical idea. You're absolutely right that at one point it becomes dangerous because undoing that history means something very real when the state of Israel already exists.
Thank you. That was our Labour Zionist and anti-Zionist pairing. Join us for episode 3 to travel further into the debate. Thank you.